This is day two of this October 2015 seven-day session. And I'm going to read from a text that I haven't read from in about 4 years, I see from my notes. This is called The Collected Works of Chinuo. Chinuo is considered, I understand, it's considered the sort of the father of Korean Zen. Just as Zen as we know it, they say, the scholars say, is sort of imprinted on Chinese Zen master Wei Nong, the sixth patriarch in China. Well, this is Korea's counterpart. Chinuo is Korea's counterpart to the sixth patriarch in China. And this is translated with an introduction by Robert E. Buswell, Jr., The Collected Works of Chinuo. It's a massive book. If I were stranded on a desert island, this would be one of my three or four candidates for the one book that I might have. It's just very, very rich in Dharma, Buddhist teaching. I've only read about a third of it. It's so dense. We'll start with the first chapter, which is the life and thought of Chinuo. Chinuo was born in 1158. That's during in China, the Song Dynasty, the Great Song Dynasty. He was born to a family of the gentry class. From birth, the boy was of weak constitution and plagued by serious illnesses. After continued attempts to cure him through conventional medical therapy, his father, in desperation, decided to entreat the Buddha. He vowed that if his son was cured, he would have him ordained into the Buddhist order. Soon afterward, the illnesses are supposed to have vanished, and keeping his vow, Chinuo's father the boy had his head shaved at the age of 7 and received the precepts at the age of 15. He was given the Buddhist name Chinuo. Later, he referred to himself as Moguja, which means the ox herder. We're skipping a lot here. the young monk's relationship with his preceptor, the one who ordained him, does not seem to have been especially close, for his biographer states that he never had a permanent teacher. Chinuo's intellect and his natural inclination towards solitude and retreat had been noticeable since his youth. Apparently the Buddhist church in his day was riven with disputes and conflict, and the translator here speculates that Chinuo probably felt more comfortable learning to get along on his own considerable talents in seclusion. From early on in his vocation, Chinuo made up for the lack of personal instruction by drawing inspiration from the Buddhist sutras. And this is a theme that you will hear runs through Shinul's life is his need to somehow reconcile the practice of Zen, or which in Korea is known as Son, S-O-N, to reconcile that with the sutras, with scholastic writings about it. I know that in China, in the big Chinese monasteries, there would be those, there'd be the Zen, in a big monastery, there'd be the Zen monks, that is the meditation monks, who focused on meditation, and there'd be the sutra monks, who devoted themselves more to the study, not to meditation. And apparently it was the same, at least for chunks of history in Korea. It was the same in Korea, and Chinul's role seems to have been to merge these two. So he spent just 9 years at his home monastery, and then he traveled to a temple in the capital of Korea to take the Zen Sangha examinations. See, it was really regulated. Although he passed his tests, he apparently became disgusted with the worldly climate surrounding them. So his interest in joining the church hierarchy, the Buddhist church hierarchy, was dampened, and he expressed himself about the corrupted state of the Sangha and the need to return to the proper pursuits of the monk's life. And he seems to have struck a responsive chord among at least a few of his fellow practitioners. Together, they decided to gather at some future date to form a retreat society dedicated to the development of samadhi and prajna. And later historians said that he seems to have been the first person in Korea to initiate the religious society movement. Don't hear about that. I haven't read about that in Chinese or Japanese Zen. Band of serious practitioners who join together to raise the level of the practice of all of them. The author here says he seemed wanted to attempt to counter the degenerative tendencies in the Sangha and practice outside the established order. But then they ran into difficulties, and the members of this would-be society or community were scattered among different monasteries, and the translator here says, we don't know for sure what these problems might have been, but it seems that they were political in nature. That's what human beings get into when they get in groups. It's power issues. Later they got together, most of them got together again and had another go at it. And then Chinul had the first of a series of three awakenings. Or at least that's what the translator uses, awakenings. Awakenings is, if I may say, is a word that has different meanings to different people. In Zen, I think it's useful to cleave to the more strict meaning of awakening as a kensho, where you see into the nature of reality. You see things as they are. It's an experience that reveals the true nature of things. In other Buddhist lineages, they might refer to an awakening as a kind of an uplifting or a revelatory experience. It's not kensho. It's not that fundamental seeing into the true nature of seeing to one's true nature. And it's hard to know here. After all, this is 800 years ago. But that's what the translator calls it, the first of a series of three awakenings. And then he quotes from Chinul's memorial tablet and to bring forth Chinul's own words. And this was how he described his first experience. By chance, one day in the study hall, see right there, we see that he was not just a meditator. These aren't Chinul's own words, but this is describing the experience. By chance, one day in the study hall, as he was looking through the Platform Sutra of the Sixth Patriarch, he came across a passage which said, "The self nature of suchness gives rise to thoughts. But even though the six sense faculties see, hear, sense, and know, it is not tainted by the myriad of images. True nature is constantly free and self-reliant." So let's just appreciate that. That thoughts originate in our true nature. They're not something apart from, something alien to our true nature. Nothing is outside our true nature. Thoughts themselves, which in early stages of practice we often demonize thoughts, but this is just the natural functioning of our true nature through the brain and its functions. But then he says, the sutra basically says, but our true nature is not tainted, it's not marred by images and thoughts. Our true nature is constantly free and self-reliant. And then that's the end of the quote from the Platform Sutra. And then it says, astonished, he was overjoyed at gaining what he had never experienced before, and getting up, he walks around the hall, reflecting on the passage while continuing to recite it. His heart was satisfied. From that time on, his mind was averse to fame and profit. He desired only to dwell in seclusion in the mountain ravines. Bearing hardship joyfully, he aspired to the path. He was obsessed with this quest. And then the translator, says this experience was Chinul's true initiation into the Dharma. In all his future writings, Chinul would stress the need for an initial awakening to the mind nature to ensure the consistent development of practice. The need for an initial awakening to ensure the consistent development of practice. This is what a true awakening, even a relatively light one, but still a true awakening does, is it grounds, it anchors our practice in faith. The faith that is experience. It's not belief. This is the faith grounded in experience. We know that form is only emptiness, emptiness only form. We know the true nature of the self and all things, all phenomena. We know the true nature of thoughts, which is empty. That thoughts have no roots. And having experienced this, not just read about it or have believed it, but having experienced this and confirmed it, then thoughts never again present the problem that they did before that. They don't torment us anymore. We still have thoughts, of course, because again, that's the nature of the mind and consciousness. Thoughts come into the mind, but we're not at war with them anymore. We see that they're nothing. They're devoid of any substance. They're just like shadows. They have nothing. They can't threaten us in any way. And this is a big boost to practice. Once we establish that, then there's no guarantee we'll practice forever, but at least we won't quit because of thinking that there is some self, some ego self that has the upper hand. So then says Chinu again took up his staff and set off in search of a new environment in which to further his practice. Notice that he's not satisfied with that initial awakening. A real awakening will reveal to us that we have much further to go. And off he went. He settled at another mountain monastery. And it says, Chinul seems to have been particularly concerned at that time with the continued split between the Zen and the scholastic schools, which was destroying the integrity of the Sangha. And he used as an example his own development in Buddhism, in which his practice was complemented with insights he gleaned from the sutras. He became convinced that the discrepancies between the two streams of thought could be reconciled. He was positive that the Zen approach, or the meditation approach, could be confirmed in the sutras. It's a view or a problem, let's say. It's a problem that I don't remember having read about anywhere else, any of the Chinese or Japanese masters. Somehow this was his project, was to reconcile these two approaches to practice, that is, practice and study. And then he came across in a passage he was reading the Avatamsaka Sutra, one of the great Mahayana sutras, on retreat. He said, three winters and summers passed before I came upon the simile, or analogy more or less, about one dust mote containing thousands of volumes of sutras. And then in the same passage, it said, the wisdom of the Buddhas is just like this. It is complete in the bodies of all sentient beings. It is merely all these ordinary, foolish people who are not aware of it and do not recognize it. And then he says, I put the sutra on my head in reverence and began to weep. And then he says, I'm still unclear about it. So then he reread a famous explanation of the first level of the 10 faiths in a commentary on the Avatamsaka Sutra. First, he realizes that his own body and mind are originally the Dharma Dhatu, that is, we could say our true nature, because they are immaculate, pure, and untainted. Second, he realizes that the discriminative nature of his own body and mind is originally free from the subject-object dichotomy. And third, he realizes that his own mind's sublime wisdom, which can distinguish the genuine from the distorted, is Manjushri, that is, the archetype of wisdom. And then he's still, and these are his words, quoting, it says elsewhere, the difficulties a person encounters in entering the 10 faiths from the ordinary state are due to the fact that he completely resigns himself to the idea that he is an ordinary person, an unenlightened person. He is unwilling to accept that his own mind is the Buddha of unmoving wisdom. So anyone who's been to Sesshin has heard this from other sources, other masters, the fundamental problem of thinking of oneself as deluded, as unenlightened. That is, dividing human beings into the enlightened and the unenlightened, when in fact we are all endowed with this true nature, this enlightened true nature. So this, to him, this was the second so-called awakening or realization Chino had of the fundamental unity of Zen and the sutras. In other words, he seems to have found the need, or had the need to have to read confirmation, to have the sutras, to find something in the sutras that matched his own experience. So he established a monastery, and he tried to reconvene this society that had sputtered earlier. Some of the monks had died, others were sick, still others had become entranced with the pursuit of fame and profit. Of the original group of over 10 monks, only 3 or 4 were able to come. Chino welcomed people from all backgrounds into the community as long as they were willing to renounce secular concerns and dwell in seclusion in the cultivation of samadhi and prajna. And 7 years after its formation, this community that Chinul had formed had achieved widespread renown and gained a large following among people from all social strata. Although Chino was still concerned primarily with his own personal practice, he had gradually attracted a large number of students. In fact, and this is a quote, those who were practicing under him had become like a city. So they outgrew the temple and Chino went searching for elsewhere for a major meditation center. And he found one in Songguang Mountain, where he found the neglected remains of a small temple. There was no more than 3,600 square feet is what the conversion is here. And was able to accommodate only 30 to 40 people. Although it was much too small for the requirements of the retreat group, the area was ideal. And then again, another quote, the site was outstanding and the land fertile. The springs were sweet and the forests abundant. It was truly a place which would be appropriate for cultivating the mind, nourishing the self nature, gathering an assembly, and making merit. Cultivating the mind. Cultivation always means practicing, working with the mind. In doing so, we nourish our true nature and we gather merit. And then he went into retreat again, a place called Songmuju, which was described as isolated and quiet, first in all the kingdom as a peaceful place, perfect for the practice of Zen. The atmosphere was conducive to his meditation, and he made great progress. His memorial stele relates that a number of very miraculous occurrences took place at the time, so numerous that they could not be recorded in the inscription, which indicated to his companions that he had attained enlightenment. It's interesting to note that Chinul never received confirmation of any of his awakenings. He never had a permanent teacher. He had, it's apparently, no one to whom he went after any of these experiences and who tested him and confirmed his experience, his insight. And yet here he is, the father of Korean Zen. And here is Chinul relating the progress he made in this retreat. Since I came from there, more than 10 years had passed. Although I was satisfied with the diligence of my practice and did not waste my time, I had not yet forsaken passions and views. Passions and views. So he still had what we say in the four vows, the blind passions. He'd still not purged himself of those. And views. I found a reference to the eight perverse views. Views is one of these words that you run across in Buddhist texts. It's usually not defined. I've always been waiting for a good full description of what they mean by views, but this is the next best thing, which is what are called the eight perverse views. And these are the wrong views of self, living being, soul, and person. That's four of them. And then eternity and annihilation. That is, this is the idea that there's no self in any sense, or that the self continues. And then existence and non-existence. So he acknowledged that he had not yet gotten through passions and views. He says, it was as if my chest were blocked by something, or as if I were dwelling together with an enemy. In other words, anxiety. He was in a state of anxiety. I went to live on Mount Chitti and found a passage in the records of the Zen master Da Wei, another very famous Chinese master who revived Koan Zen in China. And this is what Da Wei said in this passage. Zen does not consist in quietude. It does not consist in bustle. It does not involve the activities of daily life. It does not involve logical discrimination. Nevertheless, it is of first importance not to investigate Zen while rejecting quietude or bustle, or rejecting the activities of daily life, or rejecting logical discrimination. If your eyes suddenly open, then Zen is something which exists inside your very own home. And then Chinuo writes, I understood this passage. Naturally, nothing blocked my chest again, and I never again dwelt together with the enemy. From then on, I was at peace. So it's a, as far as awakening accounts, it's sort of understated. It doesn't have the drama of the enlightenment accounts and the three pillars of Zen. It may have had at the time, but this is how he recounts the experience and the effect of it. It's really impossible for anyone to look back over 800 years and evaluate a written account of an experience. I think we just have to figure that given the stature he reached and the high regard he had in Korea, that this must have been something really profound, his understanding. So then it says that Chinuo was very much affected by Da Wei's records, which advocated the shortcut approach of koan practice. And this approach figured prominently in Chinuo's later works. This stress on koan observation was even more heavily emphasized by Chinuo's successor. And since that time, koan practice has been the hallmark of the Korean Zen school and is widely practiced even today in Zen monasteries. So just to review, Chinuo's three, what the translator describes as major spiritual experiences, were all from reading sutras. The first was the Platform Sutra. The second was the Avatamsaka Sutra, and the third was, wasn't a sutra, but it was Da Wei's writings. And these guided his subsequent systematization of Buddhist doctrine. And then it describes different him establishing this temple and that monastery. And he, in one of his written works, he helped to establish ethical observance as the basis of indigenous Korean Zen, and eventually came to be adopted as the standard of conduct for all Zen monasteries there. And this monastic community that he had established grew rapidly, attracted people from a broad cross-section of the population. And his the records say it was a large and magnificent assembly which included people who had abandoned fame and rank to become monks. It also included royalty, aristocrats, literati, and commoners. There were several hundred of them who had also abandoned fame to enter the community. So it was clear that this monastery of Chinos had gained the respect of the government as well as the following of the local populace. And then there are several pages about his training of a successor. I'm going to skip that and go right to his death. I'll read about his death because it's so gritty and such detail. It makes it really very real. It's just he announced one day in the year 1210 when he was 52. He died very young. When he was 52, he announced to the monks, "I will not be staying much longer in this world to expound the Dharma. Each of you should be vigorous in your practice." And then he began showing signs of illness, and after 8 days, the end was near. He had known in advance. This is a big deal in Asian Buddhism, that it's some kind of testimony to your level of development if you know in advance when you're going to die. So they say here, he had known in advance. The night before, he had gone to the bathhouse to bathe. His attendant had asked for a verse. The master replied in a natural and easy manner. Late in the night, he retired to the master's room and engaged in questions and answers with the monks. Toward dawn, he asked, "What day is it today?" Someone told him. Then he washed and rinsed his mouth and put on his ceremonial Dharma robe. He ordered the monastery drum beaten to summon the monks of the community, and carrying his staff, he walked toward the Dharma hall. He lit incense. He ascended the platform and performed all the usual formalities. He then struck his staff and said, "The miraculous efficaciousness of the Zen Dharma is inconceivable. Today I have come here because I want to explain it fully to all of you in this assembly. If you ask me clear questions, this old monk will give you clear answers." He looked to the right and left, and rubbing his chest with his hands, said, "The life of this mountain monk is now entirely in all of your hands. You are free to drag me aside or pull me down. Let anyone who has bones and tendons come forward." He then stretched his legs, and sitting on the seat, he gave answers to the different questions put to him. His words were precise and the meaning detailed. His elocution was unimpaired. And then, picking up his staff, he struck it several times and said, "A thousand things and 10,000 objects are all right here." Finally, supported by his staff, he remained sitting, unmoving, and quietly passed away. And then his disciples held the traditional post-death rites, which lasted for 7 days. It is said that during this period, his complexion remained as if he were still alive, and his beard and hair continued to grow. These are more things you run across in the old texts that may be true, or may be inserted by devout monks who want his reputation to grow. All right, our time is up. We'll stop and recite the four vows.